Today at Reader's Corner, Aaron L. Friedberg, author of A Contest for Supremacy, China, America, and the Struggle for Mastery in Asia.
China has grown richer and it's grown stronger, but it has not moved towards political liberalization. And I think that's what's creating the growing anxiety among most of China's neighbors. This ongoing diplomatic dance is now beginning to heat up and to speed up, and it's driven largely by the desire for resources. No one wants to go out on a limb and find themselves alone in standing up to China.
I'm Bob Custra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. The typically calm yet wary diplomacy between the U.S. and People's Republic of China has been riled in recent weeks, putting each nation's desire to keep the relationship on an even keel on full display. Yet recent headlines about an escaped dissident seeking refuge with top American diplomats and cloak-and-dagger corruption and intrigue at the highest rungs of the Communist Party also serve to highlight how prickly that relationship can be. Today's guest, Aaron L. Friedberg, says a generation of American diplomats has been too eager to smooth over conflict with China, largely ignoring an increasingly intense struggle between the two titans over power and influence in Asia and around the world. In his book, A Contest for Supremacy, China, America, and the Struggle for Mastery in Asia, Dr. Friedberg argues that China intends to gently and gradually rid its backyard of American influence while becoming an irresistible global economic force. Those efforts, Dr. Friedberg says, should be challenged more directly by the strategic deployment of American military power. Dr. Friedberg is a professor of politics and international affairs at Princeton University. He joins us today from the studios of Princeton University. Aaron Friedberg, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure.
In the opening chapters of your book, you share the predictions from experts on just when China's economy will grow larger than ours. And not long after I read about that, the New York Times came out with an article talking about China's economic slowdown, cutting interest rates, retail sales down, exports down, factories closing in some provinces, three shifts a day reduced to one. Doesn't sound like a country that's going to do this overnight. And of course, the predictions don't say that. But I guess I just question, given the economic fever that China has had in recent years and this incredible upsurge in economic activity, now it looks like we're slowing down. Does that say anything for the premise you're getting at here in your book?
Well, I think it's true that there seems to be evidence now of a slowdown in China's economy. And that may, if it persists, delay to some degree the date at which China's economy overtakes that of the United States in size and sheer output. I should say that we probably shouldn't attach too much importance to that date or that estimate. There's a tendency, I think, to focus on that. Even when China's economy is as big as that of the United States, let's say, or bigger, China will still be, by comparison, a relatively poor country, if only because it has a population three or four times the size of that of the United States. So its per capita GDP will still be relatively low. But I think psychologically and in terms of sort of geopolitical symbolism, if and when that happens, it will be a major transition. The United States has had the largest economy in the world since roughly 1880 when it overtook Great Britain. So if and when this transition comes, it will mark the end of an era and the beginning of something new. I don't think the effects will be dramatic or immediate, but it will be a significant occurrence.
James Fallows has a new book out called China Airborne, in which I believe he is maintaining that China is dedicated to developing the world's largest aerospace program, $250 billion project of one kind or another. That does seem to fit into your argument as to the economic power of China and just where this is all going.
Yes, and I think the significance of that is that the Chinese government, Chinese industry, which is often very closely interconnected with government, is being focused in particular sectors that are important for commercial reasons but also for strategic reasons because it has military relevance. And aerospace is obviously one. Electronics, telecommunication is another sector where the Chinese want to move ahead for commercial reasons but also for strategic reasons. And I think this is something that's worth noting and worth highlighting, and it's a difference between, for example, China and the Soviet Union. I talk about this to some extent in the book. The Soviets really cut themselves off from the global economy, and over time, among other things, this meant that they fell further and further behind in the highest levels of technology. And ultimately, I think that contributed to the end of the Cold War and even the collapse of the Soviet Union. In the case of China, they've followed a strategy that's almost completely the reverse. They've been extraordinarily open to foreign investment. They're eager to get access to technology. And I think this gives them advantages both as a commercial competitor and potentially also as a military competitor.
You make an interesting point at the end of your book on this subject regarding the excitement, the concern people have in this country when China or when the United States and China get into these deals where China buys Maytag, where China buys IBM's computer manufacturing division. And you say, well, that may be all right, but there are other areas that if in fact China were to move into these sectors of our economy, it would in fact have apparently some impact on the military. And I think you talk about the telecommunications industry, if I'm not mistaken. Could you explain your point there?
One of the things that's already started to happen and is going to happen more, and in some sense is a good thing, is that China is going to be investing more in the United States and in other advanced industrial economies. It now has a vast accumulation of dollar-denominated assets, and rather than just sitting on them, they're going to want to invest them in profitable ways. They've already started doing that to a considerable extent in the developing world, where they're very interested in resources in particular, energy especially. But they're beginning to become major investors, or companies are becoming major investors in advanced industrial countries in the United States, also in Europe. And once again, this is something that has commercial significance, but it may also have strategic significance. The examples that you note that I cited in the book, cases in the last decade where there was a lot of concern expressed about the fact that Chinese entities, Chinese companies wanted to buy American companies. And the concerns were often misplaced in those particular cases. I don't think there's any great strategic risk to the United States if a Chinese company owns Maytag or if a Chinese company wants to buy Rockefeller Center. You may remember back in the 1980s, a Japanese company bought Rockefeller Center, and this was a cause of great, great concern. Well, they can't take Rockefeller Center with them, and they really can't do much from manufacturing better washing machines. But they can do a number of things that are worrisome if they're able to buy into companies that have technologies that are so-called dual use, that have commercial significance, but may also have military application. Fiber optics, electronics, computers, at the high end, those are sectors where there are technologies that Chinese government would like to get access to in order to develop its military capabilities. There's another even more, I think, troubling and insidious possibility, which is that by buying into or by selling products to American companies, for example, American telecommunication companies, which a few years ago were considering the possibility of buying switching equipment from a Chinese entity, which it turns out has indirect connections to the Chinese military. That transaction did not go forward largely because of concerns about security, and I think those were well-founded. If a Chinese company builds some portion of the American telecommunications network, it's possible that the Chinese intelligence services, Chinese government, could use that to gain access to confidential communications in the United States. There's another particular problem, which I think is going to be of increasing concern, and that is that some of the components that are used in American military systems, in particular electronic components, are manufactured overseas. Many of them are and have been for some time, but increasingly some of them are being manufactured in China. And there are people in the U.S. government who are very worried about the possibility that, for example, some computer chip that's installed on a piece of American military equipment or communications equipment could have within it so-called backdoors that allow some foreign entity access to classified information, or might even enable someone sitting somewhere in Beijing to type a few characters onto a keyboard and disable at least temporarily, some American military equipment. Mm-hmm. That's a real worry. It sounds like science fiction or a Tom Clancy novel, but I think it's a very real concern.
You're listening to Aaron L. Friedberg. He's the author of A Contest for Supremacy, China, America, and the Struggle for Mastery in Asia. You use an interesting term when discussing this U.S. strategy for engaging China. You call it concagement. Could you describe just exactly what you're getting at? And apparently it's a bipartisan force of nature.
Well, it's a strategy that I argue, in fact, the United States has been pursuing basically since the early 1990s, since the end of the Cold War. And it involves a blending of two elements. On the one hand, engagement. The United States has entered into an extensive and extraordinarily important economic relationship with China. We also engage with China diplomatically in educational exchange, scientific cooperation, cultural exchange, and so on. So one part of our strategy for dealing with China is to engage with them, and that's been true really since the Nixon-Kissinger opening to China in the late 1960s, early 1970s. The economic part of that has grown enormously and has become really the most important part in many respects. And the object of that part of American strategy, I think, is to gain the benefits of trade and cooperation, obviously, but to draw China increasingly into the existing international system, to give it a stake in the stability of the international system, and to discourage it from pursuing policies that might challenge that system, which, after all, was largely set up by the United States and which continues to operate to our benefit. I think there's also been the hope, and it's been openly expressed at times, although American policymakers have become more cautious in recent years about speaking directly of it, and that is that engagement will, through some mechanism, promote the eventual political liberalization of China, that not direct, but through, for example, educational exchange that encourages the creation of a legal system in China and so on, that we may be able indirectly to promote forces which will eventually lead to the transformation of China into a democracy. So that's engagement. The other part of the strategy is not really containment. That's the con in congagement. The Chinese think of it as containment. It's really balancing, particularly since the end of the Cold War and the growing recognition of China's increasing importance and the possibility that China might pose a strategic challenge to the United States. Successive U.S. administrations have taken steps to strengthen our military position in the Asia-Pacific region, and particularly in East Asia. We've done that by strengthening our own military forces in the region, by working to maintain and to strengthen our existing alliance relationships, which go back to the Cold War and really to the end of the Second World War with countries like Japan and Australia and South Korea. And we've also, in the last 10 or 15 years, entered into what I think of as quasi-alliance relationships with other countries with whom we don't have mutual defense treaties but who share our concerns about the growth of Chinese power. And I would include in that category both very small countries like Singapore at one end of the spectrum and very big countries like India. So we've been doing both of these things simultaneously. And as I say in the book and as you mentioned, I think this has become a kind of bipartisan policy with all of the debate over who's soft on China and so on. Administrations from George H.W. Bush now down to Barack Obama have basically followed this mixed policy. There have been changes in emphasis over time. For example, in the last couple of years, the Obama administration has placed a lot more emphasis on the balancing half of the strategic portfolio. But overall, there's been more continuity than change. One of the questions I have is whether that can continue, whether that blended strategy is going to be sufficient as China's power grows and whether it can be maintained. I don't think we have the answer to that yet, but I do think whoever is elected in 2012 is likely, at least for the time being, to pursue a policy that includes both of these aspects.
Well, to the extent that the engagement end of it was designed to encourage this political liberalism, it certainly doesn't seem like that's working very well so far, and we've had quite a few years here to reflect on this, haven't we?
I think that's exactly right. And that realization has begun to dawn on people who I think 20 years ago were more optimistic. And it's easy to understand why in the aftermath collapse of the Soviet Union and the spread of democracy across the former Soviet Union, the former Soviet Empire. I think there was an expectation that this process of political liberalization was sweeping the world and that China might be next, maybe not right away, but probably sooner rather than later. But so far, that's not what's happened. And I think what people have begun to realize is that, at least for the moment, the Chinese Communist Party remains absolutely determined to maintain its grip on political power. It's been both ruthless and, I would say, thus far also smart in the way that it's done that. And it may be able to go on doing it for quite some time. So China has grown richer and it's grown stronger, but it has not moved towards political liberalization. And I think that's what's creating the growing anxiety, not only in the United States, but in Asia itself, among most of China's neighbors.
I guess the other side of this coin, reflecting for a moment on your subtitle, China, America, and the Struggle for Mastery in Asia. Let's just take the mastery in Asia issue for a moment. How successful can China be in an era when Arab Springs may well be, the winds of the Arab Spring may be floating across the globe, and land in Asia? There's certainly all kinds of evidence. You can go to Burma, where Secretary Clinton went recently to reaffirm the principles of democracy and freedom. So you have people seeking freedom, and then they look to this country of China that is so unwilling to grant its people freedom and democracy. That would seem to work against China's ability to master Asia. Anything to that or not?
I agree. I think there are a lot of reasons to think that although China's leaders might like to see themselves as the preponderant power in Asia, I think that is their objective. I think they see the United States as an obstacle and as an interloper, a country that's only been in Asia a relatively brief period of time and isn't destined to be there forever. They see China as the logical, natural, and rightful dominant power in the region. They may want this, and I think they're pursuing it via various means. It doesn't mean they're going to be successful. And I'm an international relations scholar. So in international relations theory, there's a notion that balances of power tend to form, that when one country grows strong, others will tend to cooperate with one another to maintain a balance of power, so that they can maintain their freedom of action and not be dominated by power in their neighborhood. And I think we see evidence of that happening in Asia. The democratic countries, certainly, South Korea, Japan, Australia, and others, India, are worried about China's growing power, and they're beginning to cooperate more closely with the United States and with one another in order to maintain a balance. I think if they do that, there's no reason why they shouldn't be able to prevent China from emerging as the dominant power. Mm-hmm. There's another piece of this, which is, at least until fairly recently, the Chinese have been quite skillful. I think they've learned, or they seemed to have learned, that it was in their interest not to appear threatening, not to antagonize their neighbors to the extent that they could avoid it, not to frighten their neighbors or to frighten the United States, because that would provoke us into doing more, building up our military capabilities, strengthening our alliances and so on to maintain a balance. And I would have said until about 2 years ago that they were quite successful in that. But in the last couple of years, they've behaved in a way that really seems to be quite counterproductive. They've been more assertive, even aggressive, in dealing with many of their neighbors. And that's caused a lot of concern and I think made it potentially easier for the United States to work with other states to maintain this balance. Unfortunately, this increasing Chinese assertiveness also happens to coincide with global economic slowdown, fiscal crisis in the United States, economic problems in Japan and elsewhere that are making it hard for those countries to make the efforts that they need to maintain a balance. So the Chinese have behaved in ways that give us an opportunity. The question is whether we're going to take it.
You're listening to Aaron L. Friedberg. He's the author of A Contest for Supremacy, China, America, and the Struggle for Mastery in Asia. Dr. Friedberg is a professor of politics and international affairs at Princeton University. Let's talk for a moment, if we could, about January 2013. And there's either a president reelected or a new president. What does the United States government do differently when it comes to its China policy?
You mean if there's a different administration?
Right. Yeah. Or assuming, I mean, let's face it, Barack Obama's in campaign mode now, and he'll come out of campaign mode and have a full second term where he's not just a lame duck, but he's a president that has a lot of resources at his disposal and doesn't have to worry about a reelection campaign. So most people look at the second term as the term where you really get things done, especially those first 2 years, or a brand new president who has all kinds of energy and initiatives under his belt. If you're advising him, what do you tell him to do?
Well, maybe I could come at that a little bit indirectly by backing up and looking back over the last 4 years and then speculating
Sure.
about where things may go from here. In the case of the Obama administration, the administration came into office not intending to discard this mixed strategy that I talked about before, but believing that it could adjust the elements somewhat. And I think what they hoped to be able to do initially was to increase the engagement part of things, to expand the array of issues on which the United States and China might cooperate, and also to downplay, for example, criticism of China on human rights that was seen as an obstacle to closer cooperation. The Secretary of State, in her first visit to Beijing in 2009, said, in effect, we're not going to allow our differences over human rights to stand in the way of other important business like dealing with the global economic crisis, dealing with the climate change issue, and so on. What happened thereafter was that the Chinese essentially slapped the United States across the face and behaved in an assertive, even aggressive way. And the Obama administration, to its credit, I think starting in 2010, really changed direction and, as I mentioned, began to do things to try to strengthen the balancing part of the strategic portfolio. The president went to Asia and stopped in various capitals of democratic countries, but notably didn't go to China. He went back to Asia in November 2011 and announced various measures, including the deployment of some Marines to Australia, that were clearly intended to send a signal of American commitment and a signal of the American determination to maintain a balance. They haven't abandoned engagement, but they've put more emphasis on balancing. I think the question going forward, regardless of who's elected, is the extent to which we're actually going to follow through on those promises and the suggestion that we're going to do more on the balancing side. I'm concerned that the Obama administration may not follow through fully. As I say, I give them credit for moving in what seems to me to be a sensible direction, but I don't know whether they're going to follow up, in part because I don't know what is going to happen to the defense budget. And if it's cut deeply enough, I think it'll be very hard for us to follow up on some of these promises to do more to maintain a balance. And if we don't, other people in the region are going to be second-guessing and wondering whether they should, because no one wants to go out on a limb and find themselves alone in standing up to China. So I think a lot hangs in the balance, and it's going to depend on the extent to which whoever it is that's elected this year, in my view, follows through on these promises of balancing. Mm-hmm. And I'm a little concerned that the current administration has done just about everything that it thinks it can do. And most of the things that it's done have been rhetorical and diplomatic and symbolic, and that's quite important. But I think there is another piece of this now which has to be undertaken, which is going to be expensive. And I don't know whether a new Obama administration or a new Romney administration is going to actually do what needs to be done.
When it comes to the strategic importance of the South China Sea, you talk in your book about China's development of anti-ship missiles and seem to be quite concerned about just where that development could take us when it comes to a confrontation between the two countries. First of all, if you could just explain what these anti-ship missiles are.
Well, China has been investing very heavily since the mid-1990s in a variety of increasingly accurate, conventionally armed missiles, both cruise missiles, which are essentially unmanned jet aircraft, and ballistic missiles, which can be targeted against fixed installations like airfields and ports, and also against surface vessels. And the United States relies, its ability to project military power into the Western Pacific relies on a handful of bases and ports, mostly in Japan and to some extent in South Korea and now in Australia as well, and also on aircraft carriers in particular as the instrument with which the United States displays and might use military power at great distances from its own shores. And what the Chinese, I think, have been trying to do is to develop capabilities which don't match what we have plane for plane or ship for ship, but would make it very risky and dangerous for the United States in a crisis, for example, to deploy extremely expensive and potentially very vulnerable aircraft carriers within range of these Chinese missiles. The Pentagon talks about all of this as a so-called anti-access or area denial strategy, and it's meant to push the United States back, to expand the sphere of Chinese military operations and to complicate and maybe to deter the United States from ever considering active military intervention in a conflict in the Western Pacific.
What is it about the South China Sea strategically that makes this so important to the United States? I assume this has to do with natural resources, with the countries involved, access. How do you sum that up?
It's really both. I think you've touched on both aspects. One is access or transit. If you look at the map, South China Sea is the route through which a great majority of the shipping that moves from the rest of the world, and in particular from the Middle East and Africa and Europe, to Northeast Asia, including major allies of the United States like Japan and South Korea. So the United States has always had a strong interest in maintaining what we refer to as freedom of navigation through those waters, as we do elsewhere in the world, in order to assure our friends and allies and also ourselves that we can use these routes for commercial purposes without interruption or harassment. And there are increasing concerns, I think, that one of the objects of Chinese strategy is to put themselves in a position where in a crisis or a conflict they might be able to prevent the free use of those waters through the kinds of capabilities I was mentioning earlier. So that's one thing. The other are natural resources, and in particular oil and natural gas, but also fisheries. China is increasingly going to be importing food for its population, and fish is a great source of protein, obviously, and there are disputes ongoing over who controls the waters and the resources of the South China Sea. And it's a complicated issue because it involves aspects of international law on which different countries have different views and interpretations. But basically, the Chinese have since 1949 claimed that in effect all of the waters of the South China Sea, or virtually all of the water, and all of the so-called surface features, the little rocks and islands that are there, and most importantly, all of the resources that may lie underneath them, belong to China. No one else accepts that view. Everyone else in the region has the view that there's a certain area off the shore of each one of these countries, the Philippines, Malaysia, Indonesia, Vietnam, where it has the principal right to exploit natural resources. But there's been contention over that. So this ongoing diplomatic dance is now beginning to heat up and to speed up, and it's driven largely by the desire for resources.
Well, we've run out of time, but I really do appreciate your joining us today for the show and, most importantly, for writing the book, A Contest for Supremacy, China, America, and the Struggle for Mastery in Asia. Aaron Friedberg, thanks so much for joining us today on Reader's Corner.
Thank you.
Next week, longtime Idaho Statesman reporter Tim Woodward, author of Destination Idaho. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, research by Mike Journey. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Custra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.